Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about the 2011 film, The Social Network, by David Fincher, written by Aaron Sorkin. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, writer Trisha Aran.
Hello, everyone.
Writer Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And editor Alex Calleros.
Hey.
So The Social Network, when I launched the channel, it immediately became the most requested video. Mm. People in the comments were constantly saying, do The Social Network, do The Social Network. And I think it's largely because Sorkin is probably the most famous screenwriter, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the same reason that I know him, you know, his writing style draws attention. Like, it's not often that you go to a movie and you pay attention to, like, oh, people are talking a lot. Someone wrote the talking is happening. And I think that's what, you know, happens when people watch Aaron Sorkin things. And Aaron Sorkin was my favorite screenwriter. He's the, you know, that's what happened with me, basically, is watching The West Wing with my mom when I was a kid. I was like, oh, the writing is so, like, clever and smart. And I became obsessed with it. And those were the first, like, screenwriters.
Who wrote this?
I hope you've seen previous episodes. Listen to episodes.
For those who don't know, that's Brian's impression of young Michael. Boy with his voice constantly cracking.
It's going to be with me.
That fruit was just right there.
But yeah, so I remember buying, you know, the script books that they have, like some of the best episodes of The West Wing you could buy and read the scripts. And I became obsessed with them and I read them over and over again. I've watched every episode of West Wing seasons 1 through 4 at least 4 times, some of them upwards of 10 for sure. So you could say I'm historically have been an Aaron Sorkin fan, and he's kind of what turned me on to screenwriting. And then David Fincher is also my favorite director,
mm-hmm.
and kind of made me become obsessed with filmmaking and what good, smart, intentional filmmaking can be. And so when I learned that David Fincher was directing an Aaron Sorkin movie, I freaked out a little bit and subsequently became obsessed with the movie. So it was very fun when people were requesting it in the comments, I wanted to save it for a while because I wanted to, you know, do it right when we did it. But yeah, so it was the 12th video, I believe, The Social Network, and there's so much to talk about screenwriting wise, directing wise, all the things. But I am curious, what was everyone's first experience with The Social Network? Because I remember seeing it in a theater in LA. I think it was one of the first movies I saw in LA, actually, after moving down, and sitting next to my friend who was also obsessed with Aaron Sorkin, and us just being like, the first scene happened and we were like, oh my God, this is amazing. Aaron Sorkin movie form, and it was really exciting. But yeah, what about you guys? What were your first impressions of The Social Network?
I also saw it in theaters, and I liked it. And I think it was a movie I appreciated more on repeat viewings. It was that weird thing where I like Aaron Sorkin, and I like The West Wing, and I really enjoy his dialogue. But there are times where in The Social Network, like that opening scene, like, I didn't have that experience of like, what an amazing opening scene, because I literally couldn't hear like half the dialogue because like the mix was so loud with like the ambient sound, and it was like going so fast and it was so dense. And so there was times where it was almost like it was like showy in a way that wasn't actually like giving me the thing that is so amazing. I just thought of that because you've mentioned the, you know, your impression of the opening scene. The movie's great, and I loved so many of the themes and the way it was shot and the music. You know, that was the first Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So many awesome kind of new stylistic choices in that movie. And I do remember that on the first viewing, at least, when it kind of ended, it kind of felt like the third act kind of petered out for me. And I think it might be just be an effect of these, you know, did we decide it's biopics or biopics?
Biopics.
With biopics.
It's not really our decision. That's just what it is.
This is what it is. Yeah. All right. Well, I've always read it both ways. With biopics, there's always that kind of problem where it's just
right.
like reality doesn't always build to the most epic crescendo ever. You know, there's kind of the movie kind of has that, you know, that real life feeling of just like a thing falling apart and kind of, you know, just kind of having a sad, real ending. But I remember when the movie ended the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, wait, that's the end? Okay. And kind of walking into the theater with this kind of like slightly unsatisfied feeling. Anyway, it's a long description of my first viewing of it. Basically, I had a mixed reaction the first time. And the more I watched it, the more I deeply appreciated everything about it. You know, the filmmaking, the acting, everything.
Word. Brian?
I was also an Aaron Sorkin fan and a really big David Fincher fan. but a massive Nine Inch Nails fan.
That's what it is. So, hey.
So first of all, hearing all this stuff was coming together, Fincher was making a Facebook movie, which seemed really weird. But Ridley Scott was also making a Monopoly movie at that time. So I don't know what was going on.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Man.
It was a different time.
Yeah. And then, so I was very looking forward to it, very excited to hear what they did. And I want to talk about the score later because I know a lot about it, not surprisingly. But I was extremely excited for the movie, extremely excited to hear the score. I think the score came out a little before the movie. So it was one of those experiences where when I saw the movie, I already was recognizing the cues in a way that actually helped. And I saw it once in theater with a friend and then saw it again. I think I've seen it 3 times in theaters, but I saw it twice when it actually came out initially. And it's, I would say Social Network and Scott Pilgrim are probably the only two movies I can think of in the past 10 to 15 years that I actually count among my favorite movies. Cause ooh. I think you all sort of, we all fall in love with everything we're going to fall in love with when we're about 17. So it sort of becomes hard after a certain age, it becomes hard to see something and really be blown away by it. And Social sure. Network is 100% one of those things that I just feel like it resonates with me in a way that most other movies I've seen in my adult life haven't.
Weird. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Trisha?
So A Few Good Men is one of my favorite movies of all time. Mm-hmm. I probably could quote whole chunks of that movie by heart. And so that's sort of like my awareness of Sorkin going into like any Sorkin movie where I'm just like longing for A Few Good Men, basically. Sorkin as a playwright is sort of, to me, when he's at his best is when he is leaning into some of the best things about playwriting that are translatable. So, and that's like sort of everything that everybody says about Sorkin all the time. It's like, it's the really rapidly overlapping dialogue. It is the tension that is able to exist like in a room of two people talking to each other, misunderstandings, which you reference in the video about it. All that is stuff that I just super respect and really love. And of course, just like a really, really smart person who is able to articulate themselves in the most incisive possible. Like, and it's just really brilliant. So I went into that and I actually did not, I don't think I saw this movie in theaters. And it was quite a while, I think, after it came out that I ended up watching it. So I had actually already read the opening scene before I had seen it. Mm-hmm. And I really respected it as a piece of writing. Just it, when you see it on the page, which I say page. How many pages is it?
I think it's 9 pages.
Yeah, and okay.
Just dialogue.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. And functions decently well as a short film. But when you see it on the page, it's overwhelming in how quickly it is able to, you know, portray these two characters. And so there is so much about that and about the writing of this movie and about the direction of this movie that I just deeply respect and I think holds up really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's certainly a movie from masters of their craft at perhaps the top of their game. Like, I feel like this is, I mean, there's so many things to say about it, but I think this kind of was the beginning of modern Fincher, I want to say, where, you know, this was the first film he shot on the Red. And so he'd done digital before in Zodiac and Benjamin Button, but this kind of marks the beginning of him shooting on the Red and kind of this visual style that carried over into his subsequent films. So to talk about the screenwriting and Aaron Sorkin, like Aaron Sorkin is brilliant, but is also obnoxious and can be difficult to listen to. And I feel like in some ways, knowing as much about, you know, the West Wing as I did, there were moments where I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, you've used that line before. Like, that's a line
the Sorkinisms.
From the West. Yeah. And so there are Sorkinisms that kind of bug me where it's like, well, do something else. And I think what I like about this film and kind of, you know, in doing research for this video, but also watching, you know, if you watch the behind the scenes documentary that they have on this, which I highly recommend, I think it's one of the best like making of ever, essentially, that really shows like this is what it's like on set and like this is how David Fincher worked with the actors and all this stuff. But they go into how much time Fincher spent with Sorkin rehearsing the dialogue and debating and saying, I don't know that we need the third fashion noun in this sentence, and kind of beating out a lot of the Sorkinisms. And I think Sorkin needs that at this point. Like, he's become such a, not a cliche of himself, but he has his things that he leans on.
Yeah.
And I think he needs someone to shake him loose of that. And I think Fincher did a very good job of that in this film, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I will say that, yeah, I can get annoyed by Sorkinisms, and I think I'm definitely the least annoyed in The Social Network. And I think he does work really well when he's writing very smart people who are way too in their heads, who are way overthinking everything.
Yeah.
And so it actually fits in the world of the story that they're talking like this. And mm-hmm. and this is a perfect universe for Aaron Sorkin type dialogue.
Right.
So it works very nicely.
Yeah, because I think one of his things is like everybody's always quoting facts when they're speaking, and that doesn't make sense in every context. Like, I think that was one of the problems in Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which I really enjoyed, but was written as if it were people kind of like in the White House that were hyper knowledgeable about everything.
Right.
But they're
it's
like
a sketch,
comedy.
It's a sketch show. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just find this organism so interesting. You know, there are a couple of YouTube videos that are just Sorkin used the exact same story line for line in two yeah. different things. And I have to think, is this just a guy who's writing so much he doesn't realize he already did this? Or is this someone saying, people aren't going to watch The West Wing and The Social Network, so I can put the exact same, like, which is weird. It's just really strange to me. It's one thing everyone says, to say nothing of the fact that blah, blah, blah. Like, for some reason, every Sorkin character says that.
Yeah.
And that's weird because it doesn't give your characters unique voices. And that's a big problem with Sorkin's writing. But it's another to have that, to use a really important story or line yeah. or Bible passage or whatever it is to make your point twice in two different things that you wrote. And I just think that's odd.
For sure. And I think the thing that you're pointing out about, you know, his characters not, you know, kind of all speaking with the same voice, you know, if you watch enough videos about Sorkin, as I have, you know that he walks around saying the dialogue into his tape recorder. Mm. And so he's kind of always performing it. And I think once you kind of tune into that, it's impossible to hear the dialogue in any of his movies not
sure.
in his voice.
Right.
And I think that's kind of a big problem. And I think that's why he needs people to shake him out of
right.
his head and force something else in there.
One thing I know he focuses on is characters having different tactics. So this character, this is their tactic that they use, whereas this character, this is their tactic. But that doesn't actually translate to the dialogue itself all the time.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Also, my background is in playwriting. So I find myself writing scenes of people talking to each other and sort of follow the rule for myself in my process of let the characters talk. And that often results in, like, for me, you know, it depends on what genre I'm working in, of course, but I look at the page sometimes and I'll notice that there are huge chunks of dialogue where someone is sort of monologuing because I'm letting the characters talk. I think that's an incredibly valuable part of the process. I agree, though, that you need to, in honing all of your dialogue and scenes, pacing, different character dynamics, it is good to have somebody that examines every single line and goes, do we need this line? What is it serving? Why is it there? What is it speaking to? I agree with you that I feel like a decent amount of some of the most annoying Sorkin things are ones where probably no one asked him that question. Why is that line there? The other thing I know he does is write like these stutter steps where someone will start speaking. I actually really appreciate that. I think that is effective because I think it lends some amount of real world credibility to dialogue that otherwise sounds very stylized. And I think in The Social Network, that more than probably a lot of the other Sorkin things I can think of is where people give those stutter steps and it works for the characters because the characters are awkward and searching for words or whatever. So I think you actually do have to have those balancing things. I like those. It's just those longer stretches that are this incredibly well, like, phrased but not necessarily motivated monologue mm-hmm. are the ones where you kind of get in the middle of it and you're just like, wait, what? Let's yeah. trim it, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, all this said, there's a reason why we all know about Aaron Sorkin. And
sure.
You know,
yeah.
There, and you mentioned this in your video, Michael, just, you know, he was inspired as a kid by kind of the musicality of theater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there is just something so pleasurable about listening to Aaron Sorkin dialogue, where it does have an almost rhythmic, musical nature that is unique and not many other people pull it off as reliably as he does. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of just almost musical, theatrical nature of dialogue is in film is pretty rare. And I think mm-hmm. so I'm trying to give him some props while we criticize him.
No, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And what you were saying earlier, which is this is sort of the perfect marriage of characters and story to that.
Right.
I fully agree with.
Right.
Like, if anybody was going to talk like this, it's probably this fictionalized version of Mark Zuckerberg that they're trying to create.
And here. Like Harvard people.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Yeah, I feel like I'm jumping to criticizing because I feel like it almost goes without saying how like brilliant he right, is and yeah. how the movie is. When and sort of what you were talking about, the musicality and the momentum and the rhythm of it, I think that's also why it's such a great pairing with David Fincher, because so much of his filmmaking is in the momentum and the rhythm of the editing and
the editing.
The editing is insane, both visually and on the sound design side. So I referenced this before, but in a previous life, I shot videos where we interviewed sound designers and we got to talk to Ren Kleiss, who's just like the best of all the sound designers who worked on The Social Network and basically all of Fincher's things. And I feel like if you, like, you could just watch this movie and not like hear any line of dialogue and still understand what was happening just through the design of the sound and kind of what you were talking about, Alex, about the opening scene where you didn't understand all the words. Like, I'm pretty sure that's an intentional part of it. I think that's also what I kind of like about how Fincher tackled the Sorkin-ness of it.
Yeah, like, he kind of didn't worry about you hearing all of it.
It's like, maybe we don't need to know that they're talking about how many people in China take the SATs, and well, they don't take the SATs in China, and blah, blah, blah. Like, power through that. We don't need to know what they're talking about. We need to know what they're feeling about what they're talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, bombard it. And so there are times when there's dialogue that is mixed super low, where you literally can't hear
it.
And, like, in the club scene, I feel like that's
the biggest example.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
To your point, like, I understood what the point of that scene was. You know, I did miss most of the dialogue.
Right.
But I got what the point of the scene was at the end, and I had no misunderstanding about what happened there with their relationship and how this was a motivating factor for Zuckerberg. And so, yeah, you're right. It didn't really matter what they were saying. I was more upset that I didn't get to hear the Sorkin dialogue that seemed like it was really cool, but I couldn't understand what was happening. Watch it with subtitles this time, the whole movie with subtitles.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It was such a pleasure because it was like just reading the script basically and seeing the Sorkin dialogue visually. I'm like, oh, wow, I missed that. I never knew they said that. Oh, it's so great.
Yeah.
I think what Ren Kleiss does with dialogue is what Fincher does with lighting. Fincher and the cinematographer do it, like
Cronin with.
Yeah. Which is, if you're in the perfect environment to watch it, then it's great. Like, if you watch the movie The Social Network in a theater during that club scene, you have to strain to hear the dialogue, but in a way that makes you feel a little bit more immersed in the scene. And if you're in a dark theater, the dark scenes aren't going to look too dark because you're in a dark theater, but you throw it on your receiver at home that isn't quite calibrated correctly with, you know, sunlight on or something. Now you can't hear or see anything.
Yeah, don't watch it on a plane.
Which is, I think that's an interesting choice. It's an interesting choice to look at, like, the Battle of Winterfell or something, like, say if you have the perfect way to watch this, it's going to be a better experience, but for the casual viewer it might be really frustrating. And I think that's, it's unfortunate that you have to find that balance,
make those choices.
Tricky.
But it's also interesting, you know, talking about essentially what you're saying, I feel like it's a cinematic movie. It's a movie that wants to be seen in a theater in those perfect conditions, and it feels like in some ways only David Fincher could take an Aaron Sorkin script and make it hyper cinematic in that way.
Danny Boyle did a pretty good job too.
Well, so I was gonna say we should talk about Steve Jobs. And you know, that was supposed to be another Fincher Sorkin collaboration, but fell apart, and then Danny Boyle came in. And it's weird because I know a lot of people really like that movie, and I didn't hard time watching it because I feel like I missed the Fincherness that would have trimmed out some of the Sorkin indulgent. And I feel like, again, in the Steve Jobs movie, I feel like so much weight is put on the dialogue and we need to hear everything that they're saying and all that stuff. And I don't know that it is that necessary. So I don't know. I feel like that's why I feel like Fincher and Sorkin are such a great pairing.
Sure.
I also feel like Fincher wouldn't have let Kate Winslet have a different accent across time.
Wow.
And I do wonder what happened there, because Kate Winslet's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I think she's like, is American to start with, but then like as time progresses, she like gets an accent, like a foreign accent. I don't know. There was some
I think it's
stuff.
Her character going back to her roots.
Anyway.
I bet you liked Steve Jobs, didn't you, Bri?
I actually will say that I've only seen it once, and I sort of felt tuned out during it. Mm-hmm. So when I say Danny Boyle did a good job of making it cinematic, I mean specifically
right.
It felt
visually
like a beautiful movie to watch. And I feel like it's a movie that I've always wanted to go back and rewatch because I feel like I should appreciate it more, but I sort of never quite felt like I was in it the one time I watched it.
Yeah.
I was expecting to strongly dislike it, and I didn't. I mean, I love Fassbender. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot. And so I basically like...
We've seen your bedroom wall. We know.
Yeah. People listen to this, Brian. Yeah, but I just remember thinking like, if you can... I don't know, let go of, and that is what I think The Social Network actually excels at, where it is less of a straight biopic and it's not acting like it is, really. Like, it's pretty acknowledged, this is not really Zuckerberg, this is not really how it happened. Very, very dubious about veracity there. But with Steve Jobs, we were kind of expecting, this was not that long after Steve Jobs had passed away, we were kind of expecting, I think, something more of an actual biopic rather than something hyper-stylized with very Sorkin-y sort of characterizations and that kind of thing. And I think that was a big part of it. And I think it had some structural problems, too. I'm trying to remember. That's the thing. I'm trying to remember.
Right. Right. Yeah, same.
So that says something about it right there. But I remember liking it. I mean,
it's something you touched on, which I think is interesting about A Social Network, about the truth of it all.
Of course.
Sorkin wrote the script based on three different stories, basically, like the different depositions. So he said, well, it's true in the sense that there's a 33% chance anything that was said is true because everyone has their own version of the story. So I thought it was interesting for him to say, I'm going to write a version of the story based on what people have said the story is. And I think knowing that, there's not really a great way to get your audience to know that before you go in. But I think knowing that helps you separate Mark Zuckerberg, the character, from Mark Zuckerberg, the person. I've never once watched The Social Network thinking I was watching actually Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, of course. You know?
I think I'm watching this character that has been carefully crafted for this movie.
Well, and Rashida Jones even spells it out at the end of the movie. You know, she basically says, I expect 85% of this testimony to be exaggerated and the rest of it to be like totally falsified.
Perjury.
Yeah, perjury. Mm. So it's great because the end of the movie just says everything you just saw probably was exaggerated and or lies. Mm. and that's just what we're going to say about it.
Yeah. It's almost like there's like double or triple, maybe, like unreliable narrators happening between. Mm. And it does just make for a really interesting structural like juggling of things.
Sure.
Where it's, and I feel like this is a thing that I think Sorkin does excel at. Like, some of my favorite West Wing episodes are when he's jumping between times and like making thematic connections across great distances and stuff.
Yeah, I love the way he structures Social Network.
Yeah.
It's so smart. And the way it cuts back and forth and when it cuts back to the testimony, and it's so well done.
Mm-hmm. And you were pointing to out in the video, you spent a lot of time talking about the editing of that and how just very confident it is, where especially when they first reveal that we're in these deposition sequences, it is, I don't know how many cuts just in that first, like, here we have two different depositions and then this third storyline that we're going to be sort of following with a variety of characters, and just this effortless but very dense cutting.
It's dense.
It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't think it's distracting.
Right. It flows. You know, that's, I mean, one thing I realized watching it again recently was just how, even in my first viewing of it, I never felt overwhelmed by all these different depositions.
Mm-hmm.
And he's even like having kind of a deposition in the past, like with Harvard at the same time as present day deposition. Like, there's so much going on at once, but I never felt like taken out of the movie or confused by it. There's some, the way it's constructed, just kind of, you're just along for the ride.
I think there's a lot of subtle things that we don't appreciate. There's the lighting and the set design of the two different depositions. There's never a question of which one you're in and that kind of thing. And going back and forth from there to the flashback or the meat of the movie, the main timeline. So I think, I always think that with like hair and makeup, and there's so many different things that you don't appreciate. There's reasons why subconsciously you're not confused between these two different things.
Right.
Well, it's interesting also how the jumping between times allows the characters to kind of react differently. Like, I really like the part where, you know, we know that Mark is being sued by Eduardo, but then we jump to Eduardo testifying for him against the Winklevoss twins, the Winklevi. Right. and it's just such an interesting, like, mechanic and a way to show, like, they were friends, and it creates this kind of complexity in the character simply by jumping through time and seeing how they're reacting at different stages and all those things.
Just one thing I wanted to talk about, which is a little bit of a gear shift, is one of the reasons I think the movie spoke to me so much is this character of Mark is sort of this world's richest internet troll almost. And to me, like, the soul of the movie is Erica's line to him where she says, you write these snide things from a dark room because that's what angry people do these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, how prescient is that line?
It's funny you mentioned this because I had a note to bring this up of just how relevant this movie feels today.
Yeah, exactly.
How it's like the origin story of the era we're in now. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, the origin of Facebook. I think Rashida Jones at the end of the movie also says every myth needs a villain,
yeah,
or something like that. And I feel like this is kind of the myth that we need, you know, to explain our current era. Of all this came out of, you know, young white man who felt like a repressed anger and rage and wanted to kind of come out on top however he could. And this is the way that, like, Silicon Valley, like, channels that, you know, there's
according
a lot
to Sorkins.
According to Sorkins, yeah. Right.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like a myth, you know,
yeah.
But I feel like it's a very potent myth of, like, that kind of helps to explain the moment we're in now, where it's just there's all this rage and repression, and it's all bursting out, you know, in this new social media era. And I feel like it's all contained in this movie in a really interesting way that resonated with me more now than it did back then in 2010.
Yeah.
Oh, Trisha's sighing. She's sighing.
Yeah, I really, really liked this movie when it came out, and I rewatched it this past week, and I like it a lot less. And one of the reasons, not that I think it's any less brilliant or any less well executed or written or directed or anything, acted, I mean, it's spectacular. I think this movie is designed and is mostly an effective critique on the thing that you're talking about, Alex, where it's like, it is a critique of this, like, angry person on the internet idea. And this movie posits something basically insane, but which we all just sort of, like, take to be the premise of the movie, which is, like, Mark Zuckerberg, quote unquote, got dumped and now wants to get back at his ex-girlfriend. So he's going to invent a multi-billion dollar company, which is a stretch. But the thing that he immediately sets out to do, of course, is create FaceMash, which is its own especially troubling thing. And then it goes on, you know, and spirals downward from there. However, ultimately, the movie doesn't bring Mark Zuckerberg down because he's terrible to women. It brings him down because he's terrible to other men. And it sort of doesn't resolve that, other than, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, but, like,
Doesn't do both, though? I feel like ultimately the end of the movie is...
Right, he, like, yeah, still seeks her approval. Sure, because that's, like, the last shot of the movie, right? Where he's, like, refreshing the friend page. Yeah,
doesn't she bring him down in the restaurant? Like, I guess...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because
it's not the end of the movie.
Yeah, but I guess, like, why can't it be both? You know, why does it have to be one or the other?
I'm with you. I why can't it be both? Right. I just am not sure that textually it is.
Yeah, well, I think there's, using the real life story, these are mostly men who are actually involved in the real life story. So it's using Erica as a sort of framing device. But to me, what I find so satisfying about the dissatisfyingness of the ending is
dissatisfaction.
Dissatisfaction. Can't get no satisfaction. Is that after everything, after even regardless of how the deposition goes, he has enough money to buy the porcelain and turn it into his ping pong room. No matter what, he is miserable because he still doesn't have the approval of this, of sort of the one person he really cared about the whole time. And I just think, like, it works for me because I like, to me, it's like something you've said in a previous podcast, Trisha, is I'm okay with characters being bad as long as they get punished for it, or as long as it's part of the theme. And I like that character is not satisfied at the end of the movie. So that that works for me. And Trish is glaring at me, so I'm gonna.
That's not a glare. That's a look of skepticism. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is a question I want to throw directly to Michael. I have a similar thing. I'm not even like mad about it. I'm just curious, and I really want to know what you guys think. If a generation, or even a small faction, and I think this is a particularly relevant question, if people misinterpret your work, so if you are setting out to critique something, which I think this movie is a critique, if you're setting out to critique something and some people read it as a glorification of the thing that you are trying to critique, whose responsibility is that? Because I feel the same way about Fight Club. I think Fight Club is a scathing critique. But unfortunately, a lot of people have idolized the mindset and the mentality of Fight Club. And so that's my question. Whose job is it to, and I don't have an answer. Whose job is that? Whose responsibility is that? Who shoulders that burden of the fine line between critique and glorification?
I mean, look at Wolf of Wall Street. Like, some people watch that movie and go, man, I wish I could have all that sex on planes or whatever, but other people watch
what it should have been called,
right? Sam Jackson.
I thought it was Lobsters on a Boat.
Yeah. but at the same time, I watched that movie and go, God, this looks awful. You know, like I don't want to, would never want to go down this rabbit. I would not want the positives that come with this for all the negatives that come with it. I find it hard to say it's anyone's responsibility to decide how the audience is going to interpret their thing. I think people are trying to make movies that are entertaining and show multiple sides of a situation, multiple arguments of a theme, and hopefully ultimately end in a way that that shows what their take on the theme is, like in Social Network, where it ends with the main character not having gotten what he wanted, even though he became a billionaire.
With Social Network, less than Wolf of Wall Street for me, I don't sense that there's much glorification built into the movie, because I feel like even when he's riding high with Sean Parker and getting the things he thinks he wants, it doesn't feel like very victorious to me most of the time. It feels like it's never too far from the critique. So I don't know. It never bothered me that way. I never watched Social Network and worried that somebody could mistake this for like a like success story about Mark Zuckerberg, because he's just so sad and so unlikable and mm-hmm. so
and I think we
bitter.
Connect with Eduardo, and I think Eduardo
right yeah kind of... I never identify with Mark Zuckerberg that much in this movie, like mm-hmm. he's a fascinating character, but I don't ever feel like I'm like excited for the glory of what he's getting out of all this.
Yeah, you do smile when he like burns somebody though,
right? I identify with him, but in a way where I recognize the parts of myself that are that way.
Hey.
Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, High Fidelity gets me, both the book and the movie, in a big bad way, where I go, oh, I love this character, but he's also a bad person, but also I have those tendencies. And that to me is why some movies like that speak to me so much, is because I feel a little like the filmmakers reaching out and grabbing me by the collar and saying, I know all your
like,
tricks.
I
see you. And to me it is a call to action to not be this way, but not everyone's going to interpret it that way.
That's true. I really want to hear what Michael thinks.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a great question, and thank you for asking it. And I feel like my thing is, I don't know that it can resolve into yes, it's this or yes, it's that. I think it's, you know, I made a short film around the time this movie came out that I kind of intended to be an examination critique of kind of the objectification of women in the fashion industry and the Photoshop and all these things. And I thought it landed in that place, and a lot of people received it that way. But also, we had a screening at a film festival, and a woman came up to me and was like, why are you glorifying these awful things?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that did not land at all for this person. That actually, I'm exactly what I don't want to be because of that. And I think as a creator, it's a really good question to ask yourself, at least. I don't know that there is a right answer to it, but I think you should definitely have that question in your head. Probably one of the reasons I resonate with Fincher is that I think I know that he is a smart person that I think is aware of all these things. And to me, the way he tackles these subjects has all the nuances that make it okay. And it feels like it's exploring both sides to me. But at the end of the day, I think whatever you bring into a screening or a movie is going to largely influence what you take out of it also. And so you know, you could go turn the dial to 11 and beat people over the head with it, and just the whole movie is like
satire.
Being bad is bad. Mm-hmm. Or you could go the other way, where it's all nuance and it's really easy to not understand the true theme. And I feel like if you're not on one of those poles, there's going to be misinterpretations that you can't account for. And so it's kind of like, I think, probably do your best and make an intelligent decision about how you want, what you want people to walk away from, what is, as objectively as possible, look at what is in your, the text of your thing, and is it speaking to the right thing that you're intending?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can I talk about the score?
I wish you would.
Please. David Fincher is has always been a Nine Inch Nails fan. He had a Nine Inch Nails track open 7, and Trent Reznor was going to write the Fight Club musical. There was going to be a Fight Club musical.
Oh, boy.
In like, the mid-2000s that Fincher was going to be in charge of, and Reznor was going to write the music. And Fincher started cutting The Social Network, and Nine Inch Nails had released a 4-volume instrumental album, and Fincher started cutting some of the scenes to the music from this album. And he eventually just called up Trent Reznor and said, "Hey, do you want to score my movie?" And Trent was coming off a tour, and he just felt like he didn't have time. And he said, "I don't know if I can right now, but wow, I'm honored." And then Trent was thinking about it, and he eventually, a couple weeks later, called him up and said, I'd love to work with you sometime. I'm sorry I said no on this time, but maybe." And Fincher said, I'm still waiting for you to say yes." So Atticus Ross, who is now an official member of Nine Inch Nails, at the time was just sort of Trent's partner, has done scoring work and has scored a lot of movies on his own as well. And he called him up and said, "Hey, I need you to help me out on this." And the two of them got together and they started working on the score. And one Oscar later, they knocked it out of the park, and now they just announced they're scoring one of the next Pixar movies. And
exactly. Change of pace.
So now they're sort of big names in the composing community, and it just makes me really happy.
Created the temp music, like, go to for forever. Uh-huh. Just put Social Network behind anything.
Well, just in documentary. Yeah. I've edited a lot of documentaries, and it's like the go to temp music.
Yeah.
Social Network.
Did I ever tell you that I interviewed Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross?
Somehow, no.
Brian's face.
Just casually dropping that bombshell.
For Soundworks Collection, the website that I used to shoot videos for, we did it for, I think, for...
Dragon Tattoo?
Yeah, my favorite movie. we like got to go to Trent's house and like shoot an interview in his like studio, and it was really cool.
Now you're just making Brian feel bad.
No, I can send you the
Brian's
footage.
Actually crying. Michael, stop.
I went to his house. We hung out.
We are best friends, actually.
It's okay.
I'm just gonna text him real quick.
It's okay, because when I was 15, my mom gave me an envelope that I opened, and when I opened it, there were some random Nine Inch Nails stickers and all this kind of stuff. And then there was a 8.5x11 black and white glossy of Trent Reznor that said, "Happy B-Day, Brian, Trent Reznor."
Aww.
And then you were crying.
It's my like prized possession.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, the music, I feel like, has kind of changed everything also.
Definitely. Absolutely. Like, absolutely.
No score has been the same since this movie came out.
I just remember being so exhilarated in the theater. Well, right from the beginning of the score, over the opening credits, it was already interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But then the sequence where it's, you know, Mark is hate blogging, kind of between that and the final club party.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I was like, this is different. And the music was mixed so loud and just so forward. And I was exhilarated by that. And I was,
it's
so
such
happy.
A cliche to say like the city is a character in the movie or the score is a character in the movie. But this really is a movie where it's a bunch of people sitting in rooms talking, and the score and anything else in the movie sort of has to complement that, because otherwise you're just watching people talking and it's maybe not enough to satisfy you or make you feel engaged.
And I feel like it's another example of Fincher making Sorkinisms cool, because in the script Sorkin has like different songs that he like wants to be playing, and there are like rock songs from like the 70s.
Elvis Costello.
Okay, sit down, Sorkin. For this, we're gonna let Fincher call up Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross and change everything instead.
That's actually a really good point of like Fincher made Sorkin cool, because Sorkin, while I love him, like does feel a little fuddy-duddy sometimes and just feels very 90s and West Wing-y, and it doesn't feel like he's really changed with the times. He's still just Aaron Sorkin of old, and having the Fincher hyper-modern kind of aggressively cool feeling on top of his dialogue was a really fun mix.
Yeah. And I feel like even like things like casting Justin Timberlake in a movie.
Yes. Right.
Like, I feel like that's such a weirdly brilliant choice.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's, and it also ties into, just really quickly, because at some point when I released the video, someone asked like for me to do like a structural breakdown. But I've never really watched the movie thinking about the classic structure. But this time I did. And at exactly 30 minutes, act two begins, where he starts working on the Facebook. At exactly the midpoint, we meet Justin Timberlake, and then at exactly 90 minutes, Eduardo closes the account and things start falling apart. So it's also a very nicely, neatly structured movie.
Yeah. I both admire and hate when it's to the page.
Yeah.
I like it because, I don't know, I think it works in this movie because you don't necessarily notice that those milestones
That's
are
the
going.
Thing. Right.
Because, like,
right.
Ordinarily, when I'm watching movies in my house, I will go ahead and pause it, because I want to know the minute count. So I would go ahead and I'm like, oh, look, interesting. Minute 29. What could be happening? Look at this point.
Right. And significant others love it when you do that.
Yeah.
I've noticed that. Yeah. They're really into it. But yeah, this movie, those didn't strike me in the same way.
Right.
Where I wanted to like sit down and pause it, and they don't, it doesn't rely on some of that stuff. And I think that's the structure with the depositions is what makes that work. Like, because you have two different framing devices for this, the linear story that goes from the breakup all the way through the end, that part is the one that's sort of following the traditional structure, but the other cut scenes in between help you break it up.
Yeah.
And you had a really good thing in the video about that, actually, Michael, where because we are cutting away to people discussing, like in retrospect, a scene that's happening, we are able to see how they feel about it. So it cuts away to like the meeting with Sean, where they're going like, I thought he was arrogant. It's like, oh, no, he was. And then in the scene, you can see how Eduardo is actually acting in the moment. But then you're hearing Eduardo's thoughts on it from afterward. It helps to really move that scene along. And it also gives you that perspective of like, we can tell how Eduardo's feeling because he's telling us 3 years from now. Right.
Right.
That kind of thing is really clever. And it works super well.
It's almost like a way of getting narration in there without narration.
Without it being voiceover. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Can we return really quick to the casting?
Yes, please.
Oh, yeah.
Justin Timberlake is brilliant in this movie. And I was reading somewhere that someone was saying, you know, he doesn't look anything like Sean Parker, which I assume is true. I can't remember the last time I looked at a picture of Sean Parker, but I assume... I assume he doesn't look like Justin Timberlake is all I mean. But his aura, like just this confidence and the swagger that Justin Timberlake gives off is really brilliant.
They always say in like screenwriting, like, oh, you always introduce your main characters in the first several pages or whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like some of the best movies, they have that one other character.
Yeah.
Who doesn't show up until like the second act or something.
Kind of like Ocean's 11 or Julie Roberts.
You don't say. Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. Uh-huh. That's so funny you brought that up.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, and then Max Minghella I actually really like too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm more familiar with him from The Handmaid's Tale recently, but he's great in this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He provides that sort of like third voice where the Winklevosses become sort of become like an echo chamber unto themselves. And he is able to sort of like inject into that and speak into that.
But also,
in
it's
really
so much fun
way.
To watch Armie Hammer echo himself.
Hard agree.
So much fun.
Yeah, of course.
And I like that Josh Pence got to play the guy who's like trying to use the bathroom at the one point.
Yeah,
it's like they
snuck
him in there a little.
Yeah.
Although, real quick, like casting aside, I do think it's so funny how when Fincher makes a movie that doesn't have a lot of room for CG, he still finds a way. Like Zodiac, he's like, I erased the entire San Francisco skyline and replaced it with Seven. And Social Network, where there's no reason for there to be any CG. Let's have the twins be the same person with some face replacement. Let's have it be so cold outside you can see the CG.
Oh, you know, the breath does not age well.
It does. I know. Yeah, I was really aware of that.
Yeah.
I also love Joseph Mazzello, who is just somebody I want to call out in this movie.
The Jurassic Park.
Timmy. Yeah, Timmy.
So I always love the part where, you know, Mark's doing the blogging at the beginning and they like toss the like dart and he catches
into
it
his
and
cup,
just the look
he
gives him is so much fun.
Because I think that was actually sort of just happened accidentally almost. So that was just kind of his natural reaction. It was just...
Joseph Mazzello is the best at pulling faces because that's just what they have him do in Bohemian Rhapsody, basically.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know he's in that.
He plays John Deacon in Bohemian Rhapsody, and the character is very quiet, but also like they just don't, you know, they don't need him to say a lot, but they cut to him a lot and he's always just over there like
they cut to everything a lot.
Like his eyebrows quirked, his face like, huh, all of you people are insane. Right. Or
Makes some good faces.
He's also great in this. Yeah.
I also went to a screening of The Social Network with Andrew Garfield. Cue Trisha saying, "Of course you did."
or not?
What? Sorry. You went to a screening?
I went to a screening.
And it goes without saying.
Yeah. And he was actually he read for Mark, and he was actually originally supposed to play Mark. But Fincher said, you're so good at wearing your heart on your sleeve.
Yeah,
I don't want
is.
You to play this emotionally reserved character. He said the worst thing about not getting to play Mark wasn't that he wasn't going to be the main character of the movie, but was that he wasn't going to get to ride the zip line. Which in the script, Mark was actually.
Right.
Yeah. And then Jesse Eisenberg actually said, I don't think Mark would be having this kind of fun.
No,
so they cut it so he doesn't do it. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg didn't get to ride the zip line anyway.
No one, no one got to ride the zip line.
Well, someone did.
Actually, I think it was probably Joseph Mazzello.
I think it was. It was one of the two of them.
Well, that's why, you know, again, talking about the documentary, the making of, they talk about all this so much, and you really get to see Fincher working with actors, and his approach is really interesting, because in some ways, he gives the actors a lot of room, and, you know, he's asking, what's his name? You said him.
Joseph Mazzello?
The other one.
Andrew Garfield?
No, the friend of the Winklevoss.
Oh, Max
Minghella.
Right, yes.
Divya.
Divya Ranjan.
The other one.
That's the actor. He has a character name as well.
Yeah. But like there are times where, you know, you see him, Fincher asking Max, like, do you think this would be happening? Would you have a newspaper here? And like giving them, you know, lots of agency and letting the actors make choices. But also at other times you see him almost giving line readings, which is kind of generally a no-no. And so it's just interesting watching the way he works, because Fincher is so detail-oriented, seeing the places where he really cares about these details happening, but also the places where he lets the collaboration like thrive.
How many takes for the first scene, Michael?
99.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
poor editors.
Now, to be clear, that's across all the setups. It's not like they did like one setup 99 times. So they did 99 takes in a night, which I don't know, is even that crazy.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of setups in that.
And he shoots two cameras, and so you're getting both sides. I don't know.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. That's why he likes to shoot on digital.
Yeah, he's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
But it shows.
He's exacting.
Yeah. I meant crazy in a positive way.
Hey, listeners, Brian here. Just wanted to take a quick moment and thank you for listening to Beyond the Screenplay. If you like the podcast, we'd really love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to grow the show and get more guest episodes with writers and directors. Also, if you want to help us to continue to make these episodes, you can become a patron on Patreon. For $2 a month, patrons get extra mini episodes and patron-exclusive Q&As. I know what you're thinking. For $2, I could buy 200 pieces of penny candy. But let me tell you from experience, that's too much candy. All right, back to the episode.
Cool. So why don't we go around and talk about what lessons we're going to extract from The Social Network. Brian, do you want to go first?
Yeah, we touched on the nonlinear storytelling a little bit. And I wrote an adaptation of Albert Camus' The Stranger, the novella, and I set it in present-day LA and surrounding areas. And the interesting thing about that book is the first half of that book is entertaining and a lot happens, and then a thing happens at the midpoint, and then the second half of the book is all prison and courtroom scenes and dry and talking and that kind of thing. So I started thinking, well, how do I structure this as a movie? Do I make the midpoint be the end of the second act? So at least we're only one act. And I kind of quite wasn't sure what to do. And then I saw The Social Network, where you have all these depositions that happen later, and they're cutting in as mm-hmm. these scenes are actually happening as they're talking about this stuff. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. What a cool choice. And I think there's a perfectly fine version of The Social Network that doesn't include either of the depositions, you know, that's just here's the beginning to the end of the plot, and that's that. But I also think that in that movie, it's a really, as you talked about, a handy way to write exposition, yeah. where you have conflict in those scenes, but also those scenes are talking about what's actually happening, what happened at the time, and how different characters felt about it, and what their, you know, what their intentions were at the time. And it's cool. And I also like that those deposition scenes don't slow the movie down. You're not, oh, it's a deposition scene, I'm going to refill my drink or something. It's, they feel just as present and relevant as the rest of the movie itself. So I just think, yeah, it's a really interesting way to do nonlinear storytelling in a way that doesn't feel like you're trying to be cool with, like, I'm showing this scene here, even though you should see it later. It doesn't feel like that. It just feels like we're watching these two depositions as we're also watching the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally.
Cool. Alex.
So when I watch this movie, and I know we've been talking about different interpretations of this movie, mm-hmm. But watching it again, for me, I was even harder on the side of just like, this is a movie about like a deeply wounded person, actually. You know, mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg, the mythical version of Mark Zuckerberg in this movie is a very sad character to me, you know, very wounded character who has an ego that desperately wants to feel bigger and feels like he's not, you know, succeeding in the places that make him worthy, you know, so he can't keep his girlfriend, he can't get into a final club, and everything in the movie, when he reacts to Eduardo's success, you know, getting recruited into a final club, there's so much like woundedness in his reactions to it. He just immediately has to make a snide remark or some kind of a comment that kind of puts down Eduardo's success to make himself feel okay.
Yeah.
And it showed me like, oh, it's, you know, that's something really good to design in like an anti-hero character. Just, you know, make them deeply wounded and have that really be the driver of all their behavior. You know, if they're acting badly, it's because they're desperately trying to make themselves feel okay, mm-hmm. because they just inherently do not feel okay. And that really came through for me in this viewing.
And those scenes where he makes those cutting remarks at Eduardo are awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it's probably just a diversity hire. You're just like,
yeah, yeah. So,
wow. Yeah. Like, oh, that's great. Don't feel worse if you don't make it further.
Yeah.
Right. And the way it's delivered by Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah. It's just so brutal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I love about the way, yeah, Jesse Eisenberg plays that character is that it just, you can tell there's just so much pain inside. Yeah.
Yeah. Trisha?
Yeah. So my lesson has to do with what we were talking about earlier about misunderstandings. And one thing I really appreciate about Sorkin dialogue in general, but especially in this movie, is the amount of like back and forth where someone has moved on this. And this is like a large part of the video that you did about it a couple of years ago, Michael. And just this, people so frequently don't understand each other, and using that to create the sense of like leaning forward. If the character himself or herself has to lean forward in order to understand, then the audience is doing that same thing. Where when that first scene we're with Rooney Mara, we're with Erica, right? Where she's like, you're talking about two different things. I don't know which one you're talking about. It's so critical for that line to be in there, because that is exactly like the audience needs some kind of a guidepost, something to hang on to.
It's okay that I feel this way.
Right. I feel lost, but it does create that sense of, think about how annoying that scene would be if they perfectly understood each other.
Yeah.
It would just be this really annoying, heightened reality nonsense that is totally unrelatable. But the misunderstandings are what sort of bring it down into this like sphere where we can grasp at it, and creates intrigue for us for what is essentially an expository scene. And Sorkin does a really effective job at that throughout. And that's like sort of, you know, one of his classic techniques. And it's in great effect in The Social Network.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like my lesson ties directly into that.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, me and two of my actor friends, they wanted to practice doing scenes. So they were like, let's do the opening scene from The Social Network. And I was like, all right, cool.
I think I know these friends.
I think you do too.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Mikey, Marissa.
Hi, guys.
but so for like, you know, once a week for a couple of weeks, we would meet up and I was basically directing them doing the scene. And it was a really cool exercise to dive into this extremely dense Sorkin scene. And it's just, it's such a fun challenge to try to pick apart line by line. What is the subtext? What is Mark responding to? He's talking about this thing four mm-hmm. lines earlier, and she's also confused, and she's trying to talk about what she was talking about two lines earlier and all this stuff, which is kind of what's in the video. But it was a really interesting exercise to just kind of take Sorkin apart and see what he's doing. Like, it's not just yeah. people talking quickly. There's so much right. more happening right.
yes,
there.
Absolutely.
And so yeah. diving in, taking it apart piece by piece so you could put it back together and then explain it to somebody else was a really, really good exercise. So,
and let me tell you, I really appreciated your video on this, because I was like, oh, that's what was happening in the first scene.
Disclaimer, none of us worked on the channel at that point. Right. We were yeah. just fans. So we're not plugging ourselves. Right. We're just plugging Michael.
We're not going, what a great video we did.
Yeah. Michael did it.
It was like color-coded by like what topic they were on. Mm. And yeah, the yeah. subtitles were all.
Is that while you were working on the scene with our friends?
It was after, I think. Oh, okay. It was shortly
yeah.
after.
But
it was
yeah.
like, I have a mastery of, I when I still watch it, I'm like, I know every line of the scene, and yeah. that's kind of insane.
Yeah. And I feel like that's maybe something we tend to only do, or we think of as like, we as screenwriters think of as being the director's problem. But I really feel like maybe it should be something we think about more as being our own problem. Like, if I were going to direct my own actors through this scene, how would I like break it down and help them understand what's tracking with what and like what the internal like thread is? And actually being able to articulate that too is a really important thing. As someone who's a very instinctive writer, I think that that exercise of tear the scene apart, these two people are talking to each other, what are they talking about really, is really helpful.
And because Sorkin gives no help, like there's no, it's just dialogue, it's dialogue on the page. Yeah. There's no action lines or anything. So mm-hmm. it's a good challenge for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, why don't we go around and talk about what we've been watching recently?
Why don't you start, Michael?
Oh. I wasn't ready for that.
Game change.
So I've recently been watching the new season of Glow, and it's been interesting. I feel like kind of tying back to, I talked about Big Little Lies as a show I've recently watched. And what it's the multiple seasons later thing, where how do you continue a thing now that you're outside of the thing that made the show great in the first point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the first season of Glow, you know, there are these struggling actresses that get this chance to be like wrestlers, and it's kind of them taking the power back, and season two kind of, you know, enhances that. But it's season two kind of ends that arc in a really like nice, satisfying way. And so season three, I'm still in the first half, but it's kind of weird seeing them try to generate new conflicts outside of the kind of structure that they built for the first two seasons. So I feel like I'm learning a lot from these TV seasons that are like interesting and not quite amazing, but still good enough that I want to keep watching them. There's just a lot of lessons to extract. And I love the cast, and it's still just a lot of fun. So
mm-hmm.
I do recommend watching Glow.
Nice.
Yeah. Alex?
So I've been watching Euphoria on HBO.
All right.
Man, it's an intense show. intense is probably the main word I would use for it. But the filmmaking is really remarkable. Definitely really, I mean, basically if you don't know what it's about, it's just like the most intense show about Gen Z you could possibly make.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a Requiem for a Dream, Gen Z.
God.
But a lot more fun than Requiem for a Dream, I'll put it that way. But the cinematography is absolutely incredible. Amazing, like kinetic energy. In every one of the episodes, the music is awesome, and it's all, you know, the director writer is Sam Levinson, and I just think he's a really unique, incredible visionary, you know, as far as what he did with this. I think it's 8 episode just basically film.
Mm-hmm.
And all the actors are amazing. I mean, there's a lot of this really young cast, and they're like across the board amazing actors. How do you say her name? Zendaya.
Zendaya.
Although we have a friend that worked with her that said it's Zendaya.
Zendaya.
Oh, all right. Okay. Let's go with that.
I'm not young anymore, so I don't know all like the hip young people, but she's amazing. So yeah, I would just, if you're okay with some kind of shock value content. You know, it's HBO being like, look how far we can push everything. If you're okay with really intense content, it is worth watching for the filmmaking, I believe.
Nice. I am waiting for the day when at the Oscars, Tommy Lee Jones comes out in a tux and has to say, and the award for supporting actor, the nominees are Zendaya, Awkwafina, Lady Gaga, yeah. Honey Boo Boo, and Princess Consuela Banana Hammer.
That'd exactly. be amazing. I'm yeah. really excited for that.
I can't wait for 2028.
Brian, what have you been watching?
We gave Trisha Mindhunter, so I will say that I did watch Mindhunter in a day, and I will.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll let Trisha talk about it. But
you watch it in a day?
Oh yeah.
Maybe you should get to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it.
It took me 3 days.
Okay. Well, I mentioned this on the channel that I don't want to talk about Mindhunter because I feel like just talking about the experience of watching it is a spoiler.
Okay.
Like the emotional experience I had watching the second season, I don't even want to say what that was. So it's like, I can't really talk about Mindhunter. So I'm not going to talk about Mindhunter. That's the thing. what I will talk about is much more fun. I've been watching the third season of Daredevil.
Wow.
Which, yeah, I really enjoyed what Marvel did with the Netflix universe that they created. I think the tone of that universe is more up my alley than the MCU, even though I really enjoyed the MCU. I like the sort of darker, more adult, a little more R-rated kind of tone. And the second season of Daredevil I thought was fine. It kind of didn't care. And this season seemed to have been bringing it back a little in a way that I like. And I'm kind of sad that it's over. I wish they had done something more. They were trying to build to the Defender show, and then that wasn't very good, you know? So I wish they had done more with it. But yeah, I am catching up on that. I'm going to catch up on Jessica Jones. And I just think it's an interesting experiment, and I'm glad it exists. So, yeah.
Great. All right. Trisha, take us home.
It's Mindhunter. Ah. I mean, wow. I really love that show. The second season is amazing. Mm-hmm. I was compelled by the first season, but not hooked in the same way that the second season really, really got me.
I'm excited now.
I think a big part of the second season, I don't want to give it too much away, but I'm not even going to remember the character name. It's the one that's not Holden. What's his name?
Bill Tench.
Tench, that's right. Holt McCallany is the actor. Bill Tench.
That's his partner?
Yeah. Okay. That's his partner, yeah. And Tench has this... Most of the second season, I would say, is about Tench.
Mm-hmm.
Like... There are
he's more the protagonist.
There's things with Wendy, there's things with Holden, but it's really about Tench, and it's so good. Like, it raises all of these moral questions about, I feel like the first season, you know, is largely about Holden and the way that Holden sort of relates to these serial killers and these like anomalies essentially in human nature, and Holden's sort of relationship to them as being somewhat anomalous himself. But the second season really focuses on Tench, who is a normal guy. He is not anomalous in the way that Holden is. He is just out there trying to do his best in a situation that, and like, it's all enwrapped in his family life and it's all enwrapped in this new case. It's not too much of a spoiler to say a large chunk of the second season is about the Atlanta child murders, which is something I know a lot about and is a fascinating case of a serial killer. And so basically Tench's personal life as it relates to sort of like this ongoing chase of the Atlanta child killer is really compelling. And Holt McCallany in it is amazing. Mm. His performance is just awesome. So I really appreciate the almost risk, I want to say, to veer, like almost shift a main character in the show. I think it's such a bold choice, and I think it works so well because honestly, Tench is maybe more relatable than Holden.
Sure,
and so like, putting us in the seat, putting us in the chair with Tench is a really smart, interesting choice, and it works super well in season two, and it's just, it's moody as hell. It's so good.
Oh man,
really
I can't wait
good.
To watch it.
Although I hope that means season three, Wendy gets to be
the that's exactly what I'm
she's
hoping.
She's a little like...
She fades into the background in season two, but I'm hoping if season one is Holden, then season two is Tench, then I'm hoping season three is Wendy. Because her plot line in this season is interesting. There just isn't that much of it.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm hoping they really like give her a lot more to do in season three. But it's also just like gorgeously shot. It's so dark, so like Fincher. Lighting, yeah. Like so dark, and you can't see half of anybody's face. Like no one ever turns on a light ever, you know. Like, it's really great, really great.
Yeah. I will say, as a sort of warning to people in this room and people listening, if you don't know, like I made the choice not to Google anything about the case that they're investigating because I wanted the show to tell me about it, and I will say, don't look anything up.
Yeah, you should. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
If you don't already know a lot about it, because I had listened to the marvelous podcast about it, which is called Atlanta Monster.
Mm.
If you haven't listened to that podcast and don't know much, watch the show first.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Exactly. That.
Oh boy. Awesome. That's really, I'm excited to, maybe I'll do that tonight.
You really should.
Yeah, I should. Cool. Well, this has been our conversation about The Social Network. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.
Adios. Bye.
Bye, everybody.